Presented and produced by the National Public Housing Museum, this is Out of the Archives, an oral history podcast created from interviews with public housing residents from across the United States. I'm your host this episode, Mark Joshke. The stories in this episode span from 1943 to 1993, and for a full list of sources, please check out the episode notes in your podcast platform. As a part of the museum's mission to amplify the stories of public housing residents from across the country, we've decided to revisit some of our earlier episodes, sharing greater historical context to cultivate deeper understandings of the experiences of people who live in publicly funded housing. This episode, Play Ball, Sports and Athletics in Public Housing, originally aired on August 27, 2020. Sports have been the site of competition for thousands of years across the globe, with some athletes practicing and training all their lives for their big moment in the spotlight, and others enjoying their sports at a more casual level. In the United States, we gravitate towards solitary legends like Muhammad Ali, whose work also included career training for Chicago public housing residents Michael Jordan and Babe Ruth. Athletic powerhouses with larger-than-life personas and athletic prowess that makes their fame feel like a given. But sports is also more than just independent excellence. In this episode of Out of the Archives, we acknowledge and celebrate the cultural and personal economic impacts of playing sports on a professional level, while also uplifting the community building that others facilitated through recreational sports and athletics. Our first narrator is Tanisha Wright. Tanisha has had an excellent career. She was the first round draft pick in the 2005 WNBA season by the Seattle Storm, going on to help their team win their second franchise championship in 2010. She continued playing with the New York Liberty and the Minnesota Lynx before turning to coaching, eventually becoming the head coach of the Atlanta Dream in 2021. At the time of her NPHM oral history recording in 2019, she had just finished her playing career and was establishing herself as a coach with the University of North Carolina at Charlotte Division I women's basketball team. But before all these career-defining successes, Tanisha grew up playing basketball in the Mondview Heights projects in West Mifflin, Pennsylvania.
Basketball is the one mainstay that everybody has and that everybody connects with. So we all play basketball, whether you were good at it or not, you know what I mean? You kind of connect it through basketball and other sports as well, but I think the main sport definitely was basketball, because as a kid, I played football with my friends, you know, kickball, but really we all play basketball, and either, you know, you grew from there or you didn't, you know? So that was just something fun. Me and my friends, like, we would play basketball all day, every day, before school, after school.
Definitely all day.
any chance that we can get. So my love really grew, you know, as a kid growing up in New York. Obviously basketball is huge, so, you know, going outside, like, that's all you see, that's all you really know. So it was around for me since I can remember. If you wanted to play, you had to play with the bigger kids, with the older kids. I mean, I was playing with kids when I was in eighth grade, probably even younger than that, sixth, seventh grade, that were already in high school. You know what I mean? And that's just, if you wanted to play and play for real, like, that's what you had to do. But, you know, my friends and I, we would get our five together and we would travel to other places that we knew people played basketball too. So it wasn't just like we were in Whittaker all the time. No, we would take our five or six or however many we had, and then we would go, you know, to Homeville and play people in Homeville, or go to another parts of Whittaker and play people down there and different stuff like that. So, I mean, basketball was just, that was our mainstay. That's what we knew, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was an everyday, like, it was a lifestyle for us. It wasn't just something that, it was a lifestyle.
Our next narrator is Gil Walker, who was the director of residential programs for the Chicago Housing Authority during the 90s. A decade marked by neoliberal promises and policies courtesy of the city's democratic political machine. This, alongside even older systemic inequities, helped create an increasingly visible and unequal segregated city. It would also mark the city's last decade when, quote-unquote, traditional public housing, namely groups of high-rise apartment complexes, would be the primary source of government-funded low-income housing. The city's plan for transformation, which was introduced in 2000, solidified the city's movement to continue demolishing public housing that had begun in the 1990s. This policy would reshape the map of public housing, leveling almost all of its high-rise buildings, including Cabrini Green, the Robert Taylor Homes, and Stateway Gardens. In the decade prior to demolition, buildings were in a state of disrepair, which led to an increase in crime. At the time, thanks in part to the Clinton administration's Housing Opportunity Program Extension Act of 1996, a national one-strike-you're-out policy was created. The outcome essentially ensured that public housing residents who engage in illegal drug use or other criminal activities on or off public housing property would face swift and certain eviction, essentially barring anyone with a past criminal record from entering public housing and creating a pitfall for residents at that time. Enter Mr. Walker, who, during his tenure with the Chicago Housing Authority, made his name by being the city's unofficial youth basketball boss from 1990 to 1998. His role as the head of the CHA's Midnight Basketball League perfectly coincided with the Chicago Bulls' double three-peat golden era, during which basketball turned into a true global phenomenon, with Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, and the rest of the Bulls and the city of Chicago at center stage. Using basketball as a catalyst for bringing youth off the streets and out of trouble, the Midnight Basketball League became an institution of its own, a popular late-night activity for players and their friends, family, and the public housing community at large.
Vince Lane, who was the executive director of the Chicago Housing Authority at the time, happened to be in New York on a particular occasion. And Vince saw this program called the Midnight Basketball League and came back to Chicago and asked me to investigate the program. He thought it was a program that we could use here in Chicago. The reason being because at that time there were, and as it is now, there were a lot of violence and antisocial behavior going on with young men between the age of 17 to 26. And so we were trying to look for some type of programs, if you will, that could service and deal with those guys on a positive level. So we were investigating all types of things to try and do. So I went to New York and went to Glenard, Maryland, to take a look to see what G. Van Standford was doing. And I thought it was a wonderful program. However, it wasn't a program on the level that I thought that could benefit Chicago. Now, we use the same components that he did because he saw that crime was really prevalent between hours of 10 to 2. Why 10 to 2? Because young men, and then he saw that young men committing the crimes in Glenard, Maryland, which, by the way, was a close-knit Republican community. So the profile showed that between hours of 10 to 2, young men between the ages of 17 and 26 were committing crimes and that type of thing. Point being because between the ages of 17 and 26, young men, young women too, should be in the house studying, if you will. But most are out partying, having a good time. But some were doing negative things. I submit to you that if, in fact, you don't have anything positive to do between the hours of 10 to 2, you go do something negative. So G. Van Standford used basketball to get those guys off the streets into the gym, and they saw a dip in crime in Glenard, Maryland. So now looking at all those components and statistics that he used, how is that program going to work in Chicago? First and foremost, we're very, very arrogant in Chicago when it comes to basketball. At that time, Michael Jordan was just getting into his groove in the city of Chicago. We have the Chicago Public League. We have all type of leagues, and we think that we play basketball better than anybody any place else in the world. We're that cocky, we're that arrogant. So just using his model in Glen Arden and trying to bring it to Chicago would not work. You see, I cannot give a grown man between the ages of 17 and 26 a t-shirt and tell him come on in the gym and play. There's all kind of leagues going on in Chicago, so why is he going to come to the Midnight Basketball League? So we sat down with Dr. Carol Adams and her staff and me and Vince Lane, and we came up with a proposal. And the proposal was the Chicago Housing Authority Midnight Basketball League the best basketball league in the entire country. So what we decided to do was, if in fact we go pull these guys off the streets into the gym, we got to bait our hook better than anybody has their hook baited. We gave the guys brand new shoes. We gave them socks, warm-ups, jockstrap, top-of-the-line uniforms. We did everything. And we said that we used the National Basketball, the NBA, as a model. Not because we was trying to put any ideas into these guys' head that if you get your game together, you're going to the NBA. But the NBA represents the very best. And they understand the NBA, which means that we're going to use the same rules, regulations, and guidelines that the NBA used, particularly when it comes to proper protocol and decorum and following rules, regulations, and the guidelines. You say if you mess up in the NBA, you out. You get caught with drugs in the NBA, you gone. If, in fact, you commit a crime in the NBA, you gone. If, in fact, you are mouthed out to the coach, you fired, you gone. And so we put all those standards into the Midnight Basketball League and adopted our rules, regulations, guidelines that gave each one of those ball players a contract. They had to sign those contracts. They signed a contract that they would do everything possible to be a good citizen. They're going to provide for their family. They're going to look for jobs. They go do this. They go do that. We put all that in the contract. And we put the things that we were going to do in the contract. We're going to provide uniforms. We're going to provide coaches. We're going to provide instructions. We're going to provide guidance. We put it in there at the end of every basketball game, you got to go to a mandatory workshop. In that workshop, people will come in and give you information about how to help you become a successful person. In any case, now we're getting ready to do the program, and we want to put a pilot together first rather than go to all 21 housing developments. You know, you got 21 family housing developments from Cabrini Green on the north side to Oakdale Garden on the south side, and all that in between. So we wanted to put a program in each one of those developments. But we couldn't all do it all at one time because we had to do a pilot program to work out all the kinks to make sure that the program was successful. Now we could kind of do a cookie cutter approach and do everything in each one of those developments.
Gil's dedication to Midnight Basketball garnered him national recognition. He even made his way up into a feature in Sports Illustrated. Although the Midnight Basketball League couldn't solve the underlying systemic issues that public housing residents faced on a daily basis, it offered more than just a fun escape. The league offered enrichment programs that players participated in, which focused on drug education and career counseling, as well as partial scholarships to vocational schools. Despite all its grassroots success, city and outside funding dried up by 1998, shuttering the league. In addition to highly structured groups like the Midnight Basketball League, public housing complexes oftentimes contained boys and girls clubs. These clubs were community centers that offered a range of organized activities for youth, from dances to sports leagues, creating an environment where residents could foster hobbies and grow as young people. Our next two narrators, Tommy Woods of the Lathrop Homes and Byron Dickens of the Jane Addams Homes, share their experiences with the clubs and their importance of community building through play in good times and in bad.
Everything while growing up, we attended Lathrop Boys and Girls Club. There we engaged in lots of fun, pool, ping pong, board games, wood shop, arts and crafts, lots of games in the neighborhood, ledge, marble, fast pitching, flag football, boxing, boxcar races, sledding on the Diversity Bridge Hill, pinball, gurus at the Diversity River Bowling Alley. And growing up was something very special, whereas it meant that we, my brothers, my family, my friends, we saw growing up as a melting pot of a major dream of fun. So the Boys Club enriched my mind with sportsmanship, of doing the best that you can do. It's not about winning or losing. It's doing the best you can do. And with that, that helped me become an avid marathoner, where I completed 16 marathon. First marathon, 1979, at 3:02, that qualified me for Boston. And it helped me be the person I can be, to show others that with a lot of effort, a lot of commitment, you too can become a person that is dedicated to get something done. So running marathons is one thing, but it entailed me with the ability, if I set myself up to say I want to be a programmer, with some schooling, some education, I became a programmer. So the Boys and Girls Club at Lathrop Holmes was the foundation, whereas it provided a lot of fun things, a lot of guidance, and a lot of friendships to cherish.
So sometimes they went over to Commissioner Beverly LAC meeting to talk about what's needed for the youth. You know, what's going to keep them out of trouble. Because, you know, I can work with them all day long, but if the community is not supporting them, and then, you know, we limit it. Remember, I was doing this. I started in my house. And then we went to the Boys Club. They closed that down. We went to Fosco, the small Fosco. They closed that down and to build a new one. So we went to the YMCA. They shut that down, tore it down. So we went and invited Fosco first, because it's new, and because what happened when it opened, Katrina just happened. So they had some people from Katrina in there. So we couldn't use it. But then, so I went to Newberry. Now, we was at Fosco when a new supervisor came in, and he was one of those, I'd rather see him in here than to see him out there. You know, so he allowed them to throw parties. He allowed me to have a males meeting. You know what I mean? So mostly it was meeting, talking to him. You know, what's going on in the community? How can we do something different to do community events? You know what I mean? A lot of times, you know, we took them out to eat. We took them, you know what I'm saying, they was part of Fosco. When UIC had a game at the pavilion, some of them went. You know, we played, you know, the basketball tournaments. So it was more sports. We just got them active in different things in the community. So, you know, what's going on now, you know, those guys that they blaming for the crime now, you know, I had those guys. Just didn't have the resources.
These foundational ideas of community through play are central to NPHM's current artist's instigator, Marisa Moran John. Her work and creative practice is deeply rooted in community care, solidarity, and self-determination, focusing on redress through structural discrimination and injustice. Her work with the NPHM follows suit, with the creation of a coloring book and creative wallpaper that invites users to create a vivid world to turn pages to, a project that takes inspiration from the oral histories in the NPHM archive about the Edgar Miller Animal Court sculptures. Another of John's projects, called Hoops, will bring John, residents, and other local stakeholders together to imagine and design a creative interpretation of a basketball court. This interactive installation will occupy the lot behind the final museum site, which will also be shared with residents of a new mixed-income housing development. These dreams of play and sport can be heard in the stories of our next two narrators, James Purgatorio and Leroy Murphy, who lived in the Abla homes and Robert Taylor homes, respectively. They both share similar stories with different outcomes. As young men, both of the narrators spent a lot of time watching boxing, and while it remained an interest for James in his younger years, Leroy had a much different outcome.
Probably in sixth or seventh grade, I really spent most of my time with my grammar school friends. And, you know, what we did is, I said, spent a lot of time playing baseball in the summer. And we used to go swimming at the YMCA during the summer. And in the evening, played softball at McCarran. And we were all pretty close friends. And a guy by the name of Jimmy Pacenti, who lived on Bishop Street, was my best friend. And there were, you know, a number of other people up and down Bishop Street that, you know, we were close with and friends with. And, I mean, Jimmy and I also, it was an era when professional boxing was very familiar or very popular. And Jimmy and I spent a lot of time talking about Rocky Marciano and all the fights and exploits and so on. And it was also a time when boxing was so popular that at the movie theater you could go watch the event and see the boxing match there. And it was also on the radio, so we used to, you know, follow that as well.
When I grew up, I used to always watch boxing on TV. I used to watch Victor Galendez and Muhammad Ali, and I used to watch boxing. I was thrilled with boxing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was my sports. So as I grew older in Robert Taylor, I went to Hodgkin. And going to Hodgkin, I ran across lots of bullies. And they was bullying me because I was a new kid on the block. I thought I was tough, you know, and they showed me different. So I had a teacher named Mr. Young. In fourth grade, he used to let me leave the school at 3:10 every day. He said, "Boy, you got 5 minutes to get out of here before they get you." So he used to let me leave at 3:10 every day. So one day, the guys didn't come to school one day, so we had recess. They didn't. I had no problem. So I got out of school that day. He let me out at 3:10, and they cornered me. And I said, "Ooh, what am I gonna do?" And I was just scared. So I finally broke away these two guys and went up in the building, came back down. Another guy, a buddy named Ralph Spragans, this guy wanted to beat me up because I used to bug him all the time. Told me, "You can beat me." And a friend named John came down and said, "Why are you running from him?" I said, "That boy will beat me up." He said, "You could beat him." I said, "I could." He gave me self-esteem that I can beat this boy. I said, "Yeah." So me and him got in a fight. I beat him. After that, I had no problem no more with nobody. Then I had a problem with these other two guys, Cassidy King and Juicy. So this other guy named Norman said, "Look, Leroy, these guys can't beat you. You can beat them." We didn't get in a fight. We had an argument. That was it. Next day, Norman told me, "Say, you know, I'm going to take you to my gym, One Word Guard." He took me to One Word Guard. I was in sixth grade by then when he took me to the gym. And I met the coach over there, and it was something different because I never been out of no farther than Hodgkin to the building. I never went out the neighborhood because I was still young. So after a while, I started going to the gym, and one of the coaches' son was training, and he needed a sparring partner, and they let me spar with him. I ain't never boxed a day in my life, and I beat him up. Since that day, as I got in eighth grade, freshman high school, I became a popular person once I got in high school because I was boxing. I was 15, 16 coming up. At the age of 16, I won Chicago Golden Glove as an open fighter. I was one of the youngest fighters in Chicago to win an open title. From there, I moved up and started moving up in weight, and I became one of the best fighters in the city. They did a story on a magazine called Chicago Magazine, did a story on me there, and it was different. And after that, I got a part of the Olympic team. First Olympic team I made was, I was 17. I was a junior in high school, and I made the 1976 Olympic team. I knocked four guys out, getting to the semifinals. Then I ran into a guy named Keith Boone from United States Air Force. He beat me split decision. After that, I was ranked number three in the world as the best amateur in the United States.
We'll round out this episode with one more excerpt from former CHA Director of Programs, Gil Walker. Hear him talk about the impact of investing in community.
So we started off in Henry Horner and Rockwell Gardens. Now, we were going to do 8 teams in Henry Horner and 8 teams in Rockwell. We were only going to do 10 guys on each team. Why 10? Because this is a basketball program, and it's not based on ability. It's based on guys who want to come out and be engaged in the program. So only 8 guys on the team. I'm sorry, 8 teams and 10 guys on the team. And only 10 because the first 5 play the first quarter. Then they sit down. Then the second 5 comes in to play the second quarter. Then they sit down. The third and fourth quarter, the coach can do whatever he wants to do. But you got to be able to let everyone participate in the program. Unlike other programs, you know, guys will sit the bench the whole game and that type of stuff, and they lose interest. So now, we put flyers out in all the communities, all over the city. We can start this program in Horner and Rockwell, okay? And you have to be a resident of the Chicago Housing Authority. So you could come from Augel Garden up to Cabrini Green and play in the Midnight Basketball League. Everyone said that ain't gonna happen because of gang factions. Nobody's gonna be coming from Robert Taylor coming to Henry Horner. Well, we put those flyers out and strange things happened. I looked around, I had about 400 guys in the gym. 400. Guys who are underemployed, disenfranchised, some guys in gangs, some guys not in gangs, some guys graduated from high school, graduated from college. I had lawyers, I had attorneys, guys between the ages of 17 and 26 who wanted to play. So now, how do you get down to 80 guys? Well, we did the same way pro teams do. We took them through a boot camp. And girl, by the time I got through running and making guys do jumping jacks and sit-ups and so forth and so on, some of them just say, I ain't going. This man is crazy. I call a practice session at 5:00 in the morning. You gotta be on time. If you're not on time, you gotta mark it's your name. Do that twice, you know. Now, through attrition, we get down to maybe about 110 guys. Now we start assessing basketball ability. Because you don't want to put all the good guys on one team, okay? And what we want to have parity throughout the league. So we did a draft, okay? And at the draft, just think about the NBA. Everything the NBA do, we do. Gave them caps with the name on it. I use authentic NBA uniforms. So now, when you see the Chicago Bulls, when you see the Golden State Warriors, Chicago Housing State Golden State Warriors, we got their actual uniforms on. And what I'm going to do is make sure that I donate some of those uniforms to the museum, because I got some. In any case, I did everything. I mean, even the basketball that we developed. Okay, we got our own brand of basketball, and I assumed the title Commissioner Gil Walker, so my name is even branded on the basketball. We wanted to make sure that these guys took ownership of this particular program, and by taking ownership of the program, you protect the program. You make sure that it works. So now we get ready, and we get ready to open up our Midnight Basketball League. And so I wanted to have a grand opening. I wanted to have all 160 teams under one roof. I wanted to introduce this program to the public, if you will. So we didn't have it over at Horner or Rockwell. We had it at Malcolm X College. We invited the media, invited everybody to come out, that type of thing. And girl, it was jam-packed. And just so happens on that particular day, Kemp, okay, was the regional director. I mean, he was the head of the housing authority, the secretary of housing. 60 Minutes was following Jack Kemp, okay, profiling him. And he happened to be in Chicago on that day. So Mayor Daley invited Jack Kemp to come to the opening of the Midnight Basketball League, okay, along with Vince Lane and other elected officials and that type of stuff. So now we got national TV there. And girl, that next morning, I was on Good Morning America. I was on the Today Show. I mean, it took off. It really truly did. Simply because we finally found something. That young men between the ages of 17 to 26, you know, I submit to you that if, in fact, I don't have anything to do, I may, and I'm 17 to 26, I'm hanging out in the community, I'm just standing outside on a hot summer day, not doing anything, I might get into some trouble. Okay, but now if I'm going to see a midnight basketball league game, I could take my girl there. Sure, I could take my kid there. We have to stop the guys from bringing their little kids there because we're saying, wait a minute. Okay, they got to go to school the next morning. But mothers and fathers was coming out to cheer for their kids and that type of thing. I had parents tell me, and even ball players tell me, Coach, Commissioner, this is the first time my mama has ever cheered for me. I don't care how. If you could play basketball or not, okay, you got a spot on the Midnight Basketball League. We took team pictures of all the guys. We got a yearbook with all the guys in the yearbook, so all that. Just think about a first-class college program. We convinced the powers that be at the Chicago Housing Authority, let's invest this type of resources into these young men, and it paid off.
This episode of Out of the Archives was curated, written, and edited by Mark Jeschke and Liu Chen. The episode was mixed and mastered by Seth Engel. The theme song for Out of the Archives is titled Born of the Blues, written, performed, and recorded by former Stateway Gardens resident Keith Hudson. Out of the Archives is made possible through the generous support of the Illinois Arts Council Agency, the Kresge Foundation, the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, and the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. We'd like to give one last huge thanks to our oral history narrators, Tanisha Wright, Gil Walker, Tommy Woods, Byron Dickens, James Purgatorio, and Leroy Murphy, as well as the oral historians who recorded these interviews, Richard Cahan, Francisco de Salvatore, Ashley Jefferson, and Shakira Johnson. To hear more oral histories, check out the other episodes in our Out of the Archives podcast at nphm.org or wherever you get your podcasts. We've also shared a link to watch newly shared press footage about the Midnight Basketball League from the 90s on our NPHM blog, which you can also find on our website. Thanks so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing more stories with you soon.